Welcome, and I'm going to call the House Transportation Committee to order, and thank you, committee, for showing up on time.
We'll open the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation, and ditto. Nice to see everyone here. Nice that we're all together again. So I'm going to start, because I know we have some people in the room, and I want to know that we're introducing two concepts today, because I know there's some people here, so that you understand that these are for February session, so there's no, we're not discussing those issues today. They'll just simply be introduced for the February session, so I want you to understand that. And I appreciate everybody had a lot of interesting reports today, and hopefully you'll all find them very interesting. So I want to open a work session on LC 24 and LC 85. Patrick, would you just briefly summarize what the committee will be introducing into the session?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. LC 24 makes a number of changes to a couple bills that were passed during the 2009 session, and also two additional changes. There are three changes made by the bill to House Bill 2001. They deal with the revenue distribution for heavy vehicle registration fees. It deletes a requirement for funding a report for a multimodal study, which was previously funded under Connect Oregon 2. And it also deletes the reference to federal standards for the rulemaking to set standards for medium-speed electric vehicles, which is a definition that was created in House Bill 2001. The measure also clarifies the allocation of funds from the Pacific Wonderland Plate, which was created by Senate Bill 961. That was half was supposed to be to the Oregon Historical Society, half the Oregon State Capital Foundation, and the Historical Society was inadvertently directed towards the Oregon History Center, so that's being fixed. Senate Bill 579 in 2009 required seatbelts for people under age 16 riding Class 1 or Class 2 ATVs on premises open to the public. This language is being reined in a little bit under this bill so that it would be it would apply only on public lands or private lands open to the general public for ATV recreation. And then there are two additional changes. One is providing specific statutory authority for persons holding variance permits to operate over-dimension vehicles using exclusive use lanes such as bike lanes, center refuge lanes. And the last one is the last change made by this bill is a requirement, is a signage requirement for photo radar in school zones in the events where there are no flashing signals indicating schools in session. The temporary required signage must also say that school is in session that day. Those are the pieces of LC 24. The other bill, LC 85, it makes a small change by deleting the definition of applicant for provisions related to the removal fill permitting program.
Okay, Senator Verger.
Mr. Chair, I move that LC 24, dated 1-12-10-1, and LC 85, dated 12-11-09, be introduced as committee bills.
Okay, Senator Verger has moved that LC 24, dated 1-12-10-1, and LC 85, dated 12-11-09, be introduced as committee bills. And again, members, this does not indicate support or opposition, but introduction for the session. Okay. Is there any objection? So ordered. Representative Byer.
Thank you. I've been sitting here trying to figure out how to juggle the House agenda. And we have one LC that we have someone who needs to get in and out, although we have two people signed up for that bill, and we need to take care of this in just a couple minutes because the Greenhouse Gas Task Force, we have to guarantee them a half hour, and they have to be out of here by 2:45 or 2:40, actually, probably. 1:45, I'm an hour ahead. So with that, I'm going to ask, Patrick, do you want to explain legislative concept 146 and ask Paul Romaine to come up?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Let me just grab my file here. LC 146 amends the requirement for signage for service station operators to require that signage visible from the street show the price for the lowest grade of fuel. Currently, it requires showing the price for all grades and types of fuel. This would change that requirement that signage from the street show the price for the lowest grade, and that there be an additional sign visible from the dispensing pump that shows the price for all grades and types of fuel.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committees, I'm Paul Romaine. I represent the Oregon Petroleum Association. The genesis of this bill was a meeting with the Attorney General's office concerning the rules on what actually goes on a sign for posting fuel prices that are visible from the street. What under the current language, the Attorney General's office was looking at improving their rule and making it more efficient, but they really couldn't because the law requires that every grade of fuel that you have, if you're going to post, it has to be visible from the street. When the law was originally passed, there were a couple of grades of fuel and it was not a burden. Now, when you go by a service station, you may have three different grades of gasoline, you may have two different grades of diesel, you may have ethanol. By the time you finish reading the sign, you're probably in an accident because you hit the person in front of you. If anybody's ever gone by on I-5, the pilot station, you know what I mean. You're basically looking backwards by the time you get it gets to the fuel that you want. So we met with AAA, with who represents the automobile folks who would be most concerned about this. And we came up with what the consumer really wants to know is what's the price for the lowest grade out there. And then once they get into the service station, there should be a sign posted that shows them every grade that's available and the cash price, and if there's an additional charge for credit or for debit or anything like that. All that information has to be available from the pump. But that street sign, you're just getting too complicated. As far as we know, AAA's fine. We know AAA's fine with this bill. The Attorney General's office is fine with the bill. We would like to see the bill passed. Thank you.
Thank you. See any questions? So we have a Don Henning.
With apologies to the chair and committee members, I meant to speak to renaming the applicant for fuel permits.
You had me worried there for a second.
All right. Given that, I will close the public hearing on legislative concept 146 and open an informational hearing on the MPO Greenhouse Gas Emission Task Force report. And we have John Van Landingham and Gail Achterman, who were the vice chairs of this task force here.
Chair Beyer, Chair Metzger, members of the committee, it's a pleasure to be here this afternoon. I am Gail Achterman. I chair the Oregon Transportation Commission, and I'm the co-vice chair of the Metropolitan Planning Organization Greenhouse Gas Task Force.
And I'm John Van Landingham. I'm from Eugene. I'm the chair of the Land Conservation and Development Commission. We are going to try to be very brief. You have written testimony from us that highlights the report. You also have the 42-page written report of the task force. We're going to try and leave lots of time for questions, and we're scheduled to be in a Senate committee at 1:45, although you can always make them wait. We're going to try to do this as a tag team, jumping back and forth and editing each other if we go too long. And finally, I want to note that Representative Call and Representative Beyer participated in the task force, as well as Senator Dingfelder.
With that, it's my pleasure to provide a little bit of background on the task force and House Bill 2186, which was adopted by the 2009 legislature, and it formed the Green Metropolitan Planning Organization Greenhouse Gas Emissions Task Force, and asked us to really come back to you in anticipation of the February session with recommended legislation. And the recommended legislation hasn't been drafted yet, but the outline that went to Legislative Council is in the full report, which you should all have received. I think the importance of addressing greenhouse gas emissions from our metropolitan areas is that transportation, all transportation sources generate about a third, a little over a third, 34% of the total greenhouse gas emissions in the state of Oregon. The Legislative Assembly has adopted greenhouse gas emission goals for the entire state, and if we're going to have any hope of meeting those goals, we've got to get emission reductions from the transportation sector. And so that was the work of our task force. The two of the metropolitan areas, the Portland metro area and the Central Lane, Eugene, Springfield metro area, in House Bill 2186, House Bill 2001, the Jobs and Transportation Act, they were actually directed in that bill to conduct develop and conduct scenario planning for their areas to figure out how to reduce GHG emissions from light vehicles. And so our task force was really grappling with the question, which in the press of the last session wasn't able to be addressed in House Bill 2001, of what should be done in the four smaller metropolitan planning areas, the Medford, Rogue Valley, Bend, Corvallis, and Salem-Keizer. I knew there were four. Representative Berger is going to give me black marks. So we're really looking that this the work of this group really focused on Salem-Keizer, Corvallis, Bend, and Medford, even though we were also had deep engagement from the Portland metro area and from the Central Lane. I think it's important, before I turn it over to my colleague, that you think a little bit about what metropolitan planning organizations are. Metropolitan planning organizations are required by the Federal Surface Transportation Act. So these are federally chartered bodies. They aren't a creature of state government. There isn't any state statute that creates metropolitan planning organizations. And so anytime a standard metropolitan statistical area reaches 50,000 people, it has to become a metropolitan planning organization under federal law. And the funding, if you look at the table on page 3 of the testimony, it's one of the most important tables in this whole pile of materials you've received, because it really shows that these metropolitan planning organizations, they aren't local or state government agencies. They're essentially committees of cities and counties and the Oregon Department of Transportation working together to develop regional transportation solutions. Metro in the Portland area is the only exception, which is created in state statute, and it is the only one of the six metropolitan planning organizations that has land use planning authority. The rest don't. They are cooperative groups who are responsible for allocating the federal highway transportation funds. And you can see from that table that they have a tremendous variation in the amount of funding that they have. So if you look at the Bend MPO, its 08-09 planning budget was $223,000. Portland Metro's was $10,993,000. So there's tremendous difference in capacity among these organizations. So, John?
I'm going to talk first a little bit about the task force process. We had four meetings between October 15th and December 4th. The task force was created by HB 2186. The members were appointed by the governor, the speaker, and the president of the Senate. The meetings were well attended. All six MPOs had a representative on the task force, and they all came. And we had lots of other people in the room, too, interested in what we were doing. We had a smaller work group which edited drafts done by staff of the report, and that work group consisted of me and Gail, as well as representatives from three of the MPOs, Dan Clem from Salem, Linda Madrell from Corvallis, Alan Zelenka from Eugene and Springfield, and someone from Metro, Mary Kyle McCurdy from Friends and Friends, someone else. So that small work group did the actual drafting. We agreed at the beginning that we would act only by consensus. So let me emphasize that. That our definition of consensus was minus one. So it had to be two that could block. But that means that any two MPOs, and the MPOs tended to work together, could block the report. We reached consensus on December 4th with the report. Let me next talk about scenario planning, what it is, why it's a big part of the report, why do it, and talk a little bit about MPO concerns about the subject. And in the report itself, scenario planning is discussed at length on pages 12 to 13. So scenario planning for MPOs is for GHG emission reduction really is an evaluation of combinations of different land use development alternatives and transportation system alternatives in order to identify a plan and actions. So you're comparing things. Oregon's land use program and transportation planning already does that to some extent. What we're talking about here is doing with more of it, with more information and more alternatives. It can be structured to fit the particular situation of any community and the desires and ambitions of any particular community. Why do it? First, because HB 2186 requires that that be what we study. So we have complied with 2186. In addition, scenario planning is an increasingly popular tool nationally. Other states are doing it as well to try to understand how they might grow in ways that can reduce GHG emissions. This is a long-term problem. One of the criticisms of scenario planning is that it's not a quick fix. Well, this is not a problem that's going to be susceptible to a quick fix. It's going to take a lot of work over a lot of time. And so we recognize that scenario planning is a long-term process, and the effort to address the problem will take a long term. In order to test scenario planning, one of our recommendations that we'll talk a little bit more about later is to fund with existing resources a pilot program in Lane County, Central Lane. Central Lane is already required by HB 2100 to do this, and so we're going to do it as a pilot. The other four MPOs can see how that works. And then there are other actions besides scenario planning that the report emphasizes, and Gail's going to talk about those. The plan also identifies a number of impediments. We were required to identify impediments. I won't go through them all, but some of the highlights have to do with the need for funding for planning. Other than Metro, the other MPOs, as Gail noted, don't have resources, staff, or money. Another issue is authority. And in that case, there's two levels of authority here, whether the state has any authority over MPOs and whether MPOs have any authority over land use planning in their communities. In all cases except for Metro, they do not. There's a list of impediments on page 22 and 23 of the report.
With that, I think I'm going to talk very briefly about some of the principles on page 6 of our testimony. You can look at them in more detail, but obviously it's critical that we provide flexibility for local governments as they embark on this task because they are so different, that we coordinate with the ongoing planning efforts and we build on the work that's already underway that's required by House Bill 2001. And it's all got to be contingent on adequate funding because none of the, maybe Metro, but certainly none of the other MPOs now have funding to do this job. And quite frankly, it's a real stretch for the Department of Land Conservation Development and the Department of Transportation. So the task force really recommends a three-phase process. And the first step would be that ODOT lead and the Transportation Commission adopt a state strategy for GHG reductions by developing a framework that metropolitan planning and local government planning organizations can use so they can see how they fit into the overall state game plan. The second step would be to have the Land Conservation and Development Commission set targets for GHG emission reductions that are allocated to the various MPOs, recognizing that the vast bulk of the greenhouse gas emissions in the entire state are from the Willamette Valley. Really, they're insignificant, not insignificant, but they're a lot smaller contribution in Medford and Bend. And the third is that ODOT and DLCD really provide technical assistance to the MPOs, working through our Transportation Growth Management Group and other staff that we have that are experts in transportation and land use integrated modeling and have really been tracking transportation climate change policies to develop a detailed toolkit for all the different kinds of strategies that local cities, counties, and MPOs might want to consider as they develop these scenarios, because different communities are going to have different opportunities. So we've got a framework, targets, and technical assistance. The first phase is really going to be just using existing resources, doing what everyone can to explore ways to reduce GHG emissions as the MPOs update their regional transportation plans between now and 2012. And then after you've had a chance to dig into this more in the 2011 session, and we have an opportunity to explore more in terms of available resources, and the state targets are set by DLCD, then the MPOs would actually develop the scenarios. And then in the third phase would be the updating and refinement over the normal planning cycle on those scenarios. John?
So one other general point, and that is that our plan here is designed to build on and take advantage of the work that Metro and DLCD and ODOT are doing already under HB 2001. So a lot of the stuff, some of the stuff is going to be done. We can take advantage of it. They're sort of going to be the trendsetter, and we'll figure out how it works there. The last thing I want to do is mention that there's one other significant recommendation in the report for possible legislation in the special session, and that is that you all direct either our task force or some other group or some subset of our task force to continue work before the 2011 session to further develop the questions about funding as well as authority. I think we're done.
We are.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions, committee.
Madam Chair, this is not a question so much as a comment. The reason that I would be giving Chair Achterman black marks is not because she slighted our community, but because she and I went to high school in this community. It's her own community she slighted, if you wonder why she looked askance at me. Thank you. I mean, I have not had a chance to delve into this, but I can see a tremendous amount of work and effort went into this, and I just want to thank you and to carry back to those, you know, that you represent behind you, the time and effort. And yes, this is first step. We're putting our toe in the water into some very big, deep things. And I just want you to know how much I appreciate, and I will read with rapt attention, and I can guarantee you I've already heard about this from my city, so I will be conferred with them too. Thank you.
Chair Beyer, Representative Berger, thank you. I was telling the director of ODOT the outstanding qualities of the class of 67 from Southfield High School before the meeting. So appreciate that.
If I could add, I think I
he didn't go to South Salem.
I grew up in Virginia. I tried to emphasize that we, the task force, and LCDC and OTC are fully aware of the MPO concerns, and I know some of you have heard about those MPO concerns, and I can only say that we tried our best to address their concerns and to make it clear that we have to work together to make this work. It was clear that the MPOs uniformly agreed that there's a significant problem and that significant action has to be taken and as quickly as possible. That has to be balanced with their concerns about their lack of resources and their lack of authority.
Yeah,
we know that.
Tough stuff. Thank you.
I can't talk. Representative Schaffler, then Edwards.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and Happy New Year, everyone. I just skimmed over this, too, myself for the first time, and I hate busy work. I hope you can scale it down, make it simple. I want to reduce emissions because I want my daughter to breathe clean air, but you know, some of the standards, I think one of you referred to some emission control or reduction standards we passed out of the legislature in the past. Be quite frank, I don't think we're ever going to meet any of those standards. And if we did, we probably couldn't even afford to run these lights. I request that you not bring a bunch of stuff that ain't going to happen in 20, 30 years. Because I think we'll be returning back to some of those bills passed in past years, and we'll be saying, no, we're not going to make it. And then what did we really accomplish? I don't think anything. I'm not pouring water on you. I think you're trying to do what's right. And I also like the comments within existing funds and do what you can. Because you know what? We can't do everything. And I really would hate to see a whole bunch of pie-in-the-sky stuff come here, and we pass a bunch of it, and my daughter's my age, none of it happens. It's a waste of time. So let's do things that are actually going to happen that reduce greenhouse gases, and I'm all for that.
Chair Beyer, Chair Metzger, Representative Schaffler, I think one of the strongest sentiments through all of our meetings was the importance of developing this toolkit, because what we were hearing from the communities is they wanted to take action, they wanted to know what they could do, and they wanted a menu, effectively, of what they could do in their community that their community would support. So that's why that's one of the highest priority short-term steps that we're committed to taking.
And one of the screens that we talked about was, does it work? A report would have you direct us to report back, or whoever you have, report back to future legislative sessions about, are these steps working? If not, what do we do something different?
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate all the effort and thoughtful pragmatism that went into the report. You noted resources as an issue. I'm wondering if you can update me on the status of the federal flexible funds, which it was my understanding would be dedicated in part to this effort.
Representative Beyer, Senator Metzger, Representative Edwards, the Transportation Commission had a very in-depth, very thoughtful discussion with quite a lot of engagement from local government and other groups at last month's meeting on the allocation of the flexible funds that by rule we committed. And I think it's important for all the members of the committee to be aware that because of the constitutional dedication of the state gas tax revenue, we have limited ability with our principal revenue stream to invest in transit and other modes of transportation, which are a key part of greenhouse gas emission reduction. And so we heard from a lot of the MPOs that what they most wanted was revenue for the non-highway modes, because that's what they felt they were going to be able to do that would be most effective. The commission is going to be, we're taking a very hard look at all of our flexible funds, every dollar, and are using this opportunity provided by the Jobs and Transportation Act to really consider how we want to spend those funds. And I think we're going to be continuing that conversation at our March meeting. I may have the exact meeting date off, but we're going to be spending significant time and attention on that, working with all of our different partners. In terms of the funding for this project, the MPO greenhouse gas emission reduction, we believe that between the two agencies with our existing transportation growth management program, that's one of our most popular programs. It's always oversubscribed, but we're trying to figure out how we can make some funds available through that program immediately to help the metropolitan planning organizations in this exercise. And then since we're having the bigger conversation on the flexible funds, we're trying to look to other federal funds. There are some new competitive grant programs from the Federal Highway Administration because of the priority of this issue for the federal administration, where we believe we may be able to get, if we act together with all of the MPOs, we may be able to get supplemental federal funds where we could keep our transportation growth management program whole and provide some additional support over the next couple of years for this program. And then we'll see where we are moving forward on the broader policy issues on flexible funds. And that was a long answer, but it's a very important question.
More briefly, we believe that the report, the recommendations of the report, will position Oregon to be very, very competitive for federal funds.
Follow up.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Thank you. So given the variety of sources you just cited, Ms. Ackerman, by what date do you expect to have a firm allocation of the federal flexible funds determined?
have that conversation in April.
We're having that conversation in April. I knew we were having a conversation this spring, but I couldn't remember whether it was March or April. So we'll make the decision in April on the overall federal flexible funds allocations.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Call?
Yeah, thanks, guys. I just wanted to say, first of all, it was really great serving on the commission with you guys. I would like for you, one of the things for me last session was one of the things that we ran into, one of the great stumbling blocks, is that there was this real sense that no matter how much people were concerned mm-hmm. about greenhouse gas emissions, and mm-hmm. there was consensus around that, there was this real sense that this isn't going to work. And I feel like we went through a lot of iterations and a lot of ideas in this commission that got a lot of people to a point where I feel like now that there are really strong arguments to make for why this is going to work and to kind of assuage some of those concerns. And I'm wondering if you guys can kind of put some of those thoughts into words and try to convince some of the skeptics about the kind of pragmatic approach that we took, the kinds of ideas that are going to work in the near term, and why moving forward scenario planning and ideas that are still, you know, not necessarily fully developed are going to come into existence, and why this is important for the future of Oregon.
Representative Beyer, Senator Metzger, Representative Call, again, thanks so much to Representative Beyer and Representative Call for their very active participation in this group. And Representative Call, I'm thrilled that you think you were encouraged by the process. All of the international studies will tell you that emission reduction in the transportation sector is one of the more difficult areas to achieve greenhouse gas emission reductions compared to, for example, the energy sector. It is harder. That seems to be a given. But there are several strategies that can be used. And Oregon, as I hope John will elaborate, has a head start on one of the critical ones. There are some of the strategies that those of us here in Oregon are not we aren't going to be the ones that are reinventing automobiles. I mean, many of you heard the news about the Detroit Auto Show, where the feature in the auto show were the electric vehicles. Well, that's an international play. We do have some electric vehicles manufacturers here in Oregon, but we can position ourselves to be the first place that electric vehicles are deployed, and Nissan has already decided to do that with the Nissan Leaf. One of the first strategies for GHG emission reductions in the transportation sector is converting to more efficient vehicles that are fueled by low carbon fuels, whether it's electricity or biofuels, whether it's trucks that have aerodynamic streamlining like some of the trucks that are being made at Daimler in Portland, or whether it's more fuel efficient cars. So what we can do is to do things like the carbon fuel standard that DEQ is working on now as a result of legislation in the 11th session, and doing things like we have been doing to position ourselves to develop the electric vehicle charging infrastructure with leadership from our utility partners and others. So technology is one way. We're early adopters. We have more Priuses per capita than any other state in the United States. We're early adopters, so we think we can make great strides there. The second area beyond the vehicle efficiency and low carbon fuel standards, which can kind of be lumped into a technology standard, is optimization of the operation of the existing facilities. So you've got a lot of emissions from people sitting in congestion. And so the Oregon Department of Transportation is moving very aggressively to work on a variety of strategies to improve system operations, which has multiple benefits because nobody likes to sit in congestion. It bottlenecks freight, it costs everybody a lot of time. And so we're working hard, independently of this area effort, on those optimization strategies for the existing facilities. And then the final area that I'll turn to my colleague to address is that we've got a 35-year head start on everybody else in the United States on transportation land use integration, which is the other major strategy for GHG emission reduction. John?
So I wanted to note first that, as I mentioned earlier, the MPOs agree there's a problem and feel that they can and should do something about it. So they don't need convincing. I think a lot of people in the public probably do need a better understanding of the problem and what can be done about it. And the report makes a big deal out of the need for us to, at the state level and at the MPO level, to develop a citizen involvement strategy to educate people about the issue, what we can do about the issue, and how that would affect their lives if we do or don't. So I wouldn't say that everybody is convinced, but I think we have a roadmap for how we might move forward at getting to a better agreement.
I thought you were going to talk about land use transportation.
I don't always do.
Seen any hands down here? And I, Representative Schaffler and Representative Benz.
What some call skeptics, others may call a realist or a pragmatist. That just thought I'd throw that out there. I also read somewhere that the average wage or salary of someone who owns a Prius is above $100,000. Average working man or woman ain't going to be able to afford a Prius. And also, I don't know if we're switching out one technology for another on the global grand scheme of everything. Are we really creating a cleaner world? That question has yet to be answered too. And I don't know how down in the weeds you're going to get with this, but on the congestion, look, we can get rid of a lot of congestion right up by where I live by building us a great big bridge and improving a lot of highway up there. I thought maybe that would help you.
I wrote down, build a big bridge.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little confused from your testimony. You seem to be saying two different things pretty clearly. First, hurry up and wait for technology to catch up with Oregon, because we've already done a lot, and we're just waiting for the electric cars to get here, and everything will be, that's the solution, because most of the problem is cars, exhaust. But I hear you saying that there's lots of things we could do, we just need to plan. And yet this document suggests we just wait for 2 years, and that we're doing all kinds of things now, we just need to put them, write them down more effectively in this report. So I guess I need to hear, what are you really telling us? Wait 2 years because we don't have the money right now? Or is there something we're actually doing right now that actually fits what's in this report?
So Chair Fire, Chair Metzger, Representative Benz, apologize for not being clear. We're actually recommending all those things. We are being pragmatic with the assistance of our legislative members of our task force, and assuming that there would not be any funding, additional funding in the special session for anything. If there were, then I think you might see us asking for money to start doing things now. Bend, I believe, could use assistance with the transit system. Lots of local governments could use assistance. A number of them, MBOs have emphasized to us, they have some good ideas now. They don't have the funding to do it. So if the money were there, we'd be asking for it. But there's also a lot of work that, in terms of planning, that can happen now. The other thing I want to say is that I think, and Gail knows far more about the technical fix stuff than I do. I'm not a transportation person. Our assumption is that the technological fixes are not enough.
That's right.
To get you there. Nor are the planning things enough by themselves. That we have to do those two things plus other things that we haven't figured out yet if we want to get there. Representative Schaffler has already indicated that he's got some doubts about whether we're going to get there. I don't know. But it's not just one or the other. It's all those. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, actually, no. But I appreciate the effort. But it seems to me that we are wanting something that will only happen as a result of the change in the automobile, which I believe the federal government is making an attempt to do by raising the mileage standards and all of that. And I'm just curious, how much time and effort did you guys conclude, because it seems like you did in this report, that we will simply shuffle paper for 2 years and wait for this to kind of catch up? Because I must say, we're not doing anything in this report. It says we don't have the money, and let's wait the 2 years. That's what I see here.
I think we are doing something in those 2 years. As I tried to say earlier, Metro was required by 2001 to do a number of things with ODOT's help and with DLCD's help, and that we're going to take advantage of that. In addition, the MPO's made it clear to us that they want some guidance before they actually have to do anything. So maybe the MPOs are saying give us some more time, but they want guidance on what the state strategy is, what their targets are, what the tools are, what the best things to do are. So
Chair Metzger, Representative Benz, let me see if I can put it in a nutshell. Number one, the change in vehicle technology and change in fuels in and of themselves are not going to get the GHG reductions that we need. It's going to take more than those two things. Even if you did everything you can conceivably do over the next 20 years on those two things, you still won't meet the targets, and I won't go into the explanation of that, but it's not enough. Number two, what this task force is saying is that during this period when Metro and Central Lane are testing out these methods, one of the things that we have to do in transportation planning is develop entirely new analytical models to figure out what the smart choices are for our communities. We don't have the analytical models to do that right now. Using existing resources, ODOT is developing those models. We have one of the best transportation planning shops in the world, literally. And so we've got to build the analytical tools that we need so that we can give, so that communities can see what their choices are and make their own decisions about what strategies they want to pursue, whether working in land use transportation integration, working on providing transit choices, working on providing other modes. And so what we're doing is using the resources we have right now to get the analytical tools built and to be able to develop the guidelines and essentially the toolkits, the technical assistance that cities and counties are asking us for, get that developed. Central Lane and Metro will then be done with the scenario planning, and we can take it to the next step. So it's not that we're twiddling, it's not that we're just paper shuffling. What we're doing is building the analytic capacity and technical assistance capacity to enable cities, counties, and MPOs to make these choices, recognizing that different communities are going to make different kinds of choices.
Thank you.
Follow up,
Chair. Sure.
Thank you for your indulgence. I appreciate that answer, Ms. Ackerman. I am just struck by the fact that we are going to use existing resources, which suggests that we either are all doing it or we're going to shift away from something we were doing into this. And if that indeed is the case, then I guess we are going to be doing something new and different inside the department. Okay. Thank you.
Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Gail John, thank you very much for your work on this committee and this task force. I kind of have a general observation, kind of comment, and I'd like to get your response specifically about sort of the public reaction to the types of things that are being proposed within these task force. One of the things that I've seen so far in the work we've done in GHG is that there are unintended consequences upon which we're really trying to do is change the lifestyles or the current practices of Oregonians in what they do in their current lifestyle. In transportation, if we're really going to talk about greenhouse gas reduction, you've got to be talking about reducing the vehicle miles traveled. I mean, really, that's the only way you're going to get at this. And that's kind of the unstated situation here. And one of the problems we're running into is that there's this planning situation where these things are sort of done in isolation. Let's just take this last session. We had passed a bill to basically eliminate the use of coal as a energy source in the state of Oregon. We had some efforts to limit where we could put wave energy. We've had some land use limitations on where we can put geothermal. We now have some public backlash to the wind energy. We clearly are reducing how much hydroelectric power we can get. So then we shift to LNG, and now we have an audience here full of people who are upset about LNG. And what I'm afraid of is we start down the path where we spend quite a bit of resources talking about transportation, and what we're really doing is talking about changing people's lifestyles. Really, ultimately what we're doing, and I'm not sure the public's going to be with us on that. So what ends up happening is we march down this path, we do these planning steps, but the public rejects the kind of lifestyle changes we're asking them to make as far as reducing the number of vehicle miles traveled, or they can't afford the kind of cars that we're talking about that we want them to move towards. There could be higher taxes. And I'm wondering, when I looked at the report, it's sort of on page 27, it talks about public involvement. And ultimately, at the end of the day, you've got to have public buy-in before you even start this process. And I kind of want to get your feedback on that.
Chair Beyer, Chair Metzger, Senator George, I think that while the reference to public involvement might be on page 27. It was front and center throughout the conversation, and there were a number of members of our task force who emphasized that over and over again, that none of this is going to work if we don't really engage in a public conversation about which of the strategies make sense to Oregonians and which may not make sense to Oregonians. I agree with you that reducing the number of vehicle miles traveled is certainly one component of greenhouse gas emission reduction. But I think from the standpoint of the Oregon Department of Transportation, our objective is to, and if you, in the Oregon Transportation Plan, our emphasis is on providing people with choices, not to make anybody reduce how many miles they drive, but giving them the choices to not drive in a single occupancy vehicle or not drive as much in a single occupancy vehicle, so that it really is a matter of choice. And if the choices aren't sufficiently attractive that Oregonians choose them, or if they're so expensive that even though they might like to choose them, they can't, then it's not going to work, because certainly the Oregon Department of Transportation isn't in the business of telling people who can drive and who can't drive. And so it's really a question of providing people with the choices and making decisions that on the land use and transportation side that make it easy to choose another option. And so I agree with you that this is all going to ultimately depend upon the interest and commitment of Oregonians and whether they do or don't want to make certain kinds of behavior changes, and frankly, obviously the affordability of those choices.
I'd like to add that the questions that you're raising are certainly legitimate questions, but we haven't gotten there yet. That's not this report yet. The MPOs are very, very different. I mean, Metro versus Medford, very different in their communities and how they want to grow in their communities. There will not be one size fits all in whatever comes out of this. And we have not gotten to the point. You will not find anything in this report that says that everybody must drive a Prius or you're going to be allotted 100 miles a year and that's it. Maybe that comes. I don't know. But we're going to have to work it through the MPOs to get to somewhere next.
Well, actually, the MPOs are the ones who are going to ultimately make the decisions in their regional transportation plans. We're just giving them we're trying to develop a set of options that they can consider and have conversations about in their communities.
It's not clear that we have authority over MPOs to make them do anything at this point. You may well give us that, or somebody, that authority in the future and say to them that MPOs have to do something, but that's not this report yet.
Real quick. I appreciate that, and I think that's kind of what I'm looking for. One of the things is TUF is representing a suburban/rural district. Mm-hmm. It seems like we get hit really hard with a lot of these decisions that perhaps is viewed as an urban Portland decision. So, you know, there's all these environmental concerns. We shift energy, and now my district has to deal with LNG pipelines. You know, I mean, there's the ramifications of somebody's decision to eliminate all these energy choices shifts a burden to another area of the state, and so we start talking about a suburban district like a lot of us here represent. Our people drive to work and do those kinds of, and that's their lifestyle, and the burden could disproportionately fall on certain parts of the state if this isn't done with full buy-in from the public, and that's all I'm trying to say.
You probably missed the recommendation on page 30 to prohibit pickup trucks.
I own a one-ton.
Well, and I want to thank you for being.
I'm rather skeptical about that part of it.
I don't think that's going too far.
I do have a couple comments before you leave, and we can let Senator Dingfelder wait a couple minutes, but. I appreciate all the work that went on. It was pretty tight timelines that brought us this. I will say, having worked on this through the 2009 session and then over the interim now, I keep going back to my same concerns, and they haven't changed, and I don't think anybody here is going to be surprised, you know, when I reiterate that the funding issue, which you have mentioned, and the governance issue are the two things that I have real concerns about. And to follow up on Representative Benz's comments, I could be quoted as saying, I am not real crazy about voting for something that is going to shift dollars to new programs that is now being used for programs that local governments are required to do. And so we have very limited existing dollars, and the direction this is taking us, and not having a bill, I'll have to see what the bill says, is that we are kind of asking the department to shift their focus a little bit and shift their dollars. And these are dollars that our local governments depend on. And they want to do this work. They are doing a lot of this work now. I mean, and we heard during this task force that lists of things that local governments are doing at this point in time. So I think that, you know, I'm waiting. I'm trying. The local governments are the ones that have to do this work. They have been willing to come to the table. They're willing to work on this. And I'm not going to be the one to throw a big bucket of water on it. But the funding issue is very important to me. And I certainly also, you know, even you saying that we may want to give them the authority to make these decisions, I don't. I'm not that crazy about giving them authority to make these decisions. You know, that's what our city councils are for. That's what our county commission is for. And I think it's really up to the local governments if they want to enter into another level, such as what Portland Metro has. And so these are the issues that are going to continuously follow me. I need to be convinced as we go along. And I do think this is a long-range project that, you know, this is just a very small first step. And with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Okay, we're going to have an update on projects funded by House Bill 2001. And with that, Mr. Doug Tindall from the Department of Transportation, if he would come forward.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. Doug Tindall, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Transportation. Back for the quarterly update on projects in House Bill 2001, Section 64. What you have in front of you is actually two pieces of paper. One, the very thick piece of paper I'm going to get to first. This is the update on the projects that were included in House Bill 64. You'll see a couple pages of testimony. Not a lot has changed since I talked to you a few months ago. We do have projects that are one's almost complete on US 97, where we were able to use JTA money to supplement a project to really complete that project. A couple others are underway, so we are continuing to move forward both on the construction and on the design phases of projects. The large spreadsheet, the folded spreadsheet behind those two pages of testimony are the projects as you saw them when I last talked to you about the status. And then following that, I really want to call your attention to the project sheets. And this is what, as I told you last time, we feel like the intent of the legislation, and we feel like the right direction to go is to get away from those sort of sterile spreadsheet sorts of lists and start to describe the project with the requirements that were in the bill about what does the project do, why is the project needed, what's the time frame, all of those sorts of things. And so you will see then in the back of that testimony a page for each of those projects, two-sided, that goes into some of those descriptions. That is, I think, the basis of how we need to start talking about projects in the future with the public. And it really rolls into then the second one-page piece of testimony that talks about the website. And you see on the screen what the website looks like. We are not quite ready to go live yet. I can show you an example of what you'll see. This is the interface that you see here, the screen that you see here, is the same screen that you see when you go to trip check to look at the cameras or to get road conditions. And if you go to a quadrant of the state, well, it's supposed to... Okay, so it pops up within the quadrant of the state, and then these are the projects that are in Section 64 in that quadrant of the state. And I can go and select a project, and it will bring up this same, it'll bring up this summary document that kind of gives you a quick glance at what's going on. And then we have available, or will have available for each project, the same fact sheet that you see in the testimony. Well, you would normally see that. We'll find out what happens here. Anyway, the same, we're going to use the same type of information that you see, and there it is, in the those fact sheets, so that people will be able to go to an interface that they've seen before. They'll be able to get information about those projects, and then they'll be able to drill down to get all of the information that's in here without having to pack around a lot of paper. The where we go with this in the future, first, we're just weeks away from making sure all of the information is loaded up and loaded up correctly. That's one thing that we want to be very careful with, is to try not to send out any misinformation. We've done this within the existing interface, and I think there was some discussion with the legislature about that, about let's not go out and recreate the wheel again, and so we worked with what we already have in TripCheck, and so we've done it relatively inexpensively. And then where we go from here is eventually we're going to try project blogs, where you get to this point where you've got descriptive information about the project and a mechanism to get public feedback at a much more interactive level than we're able to do today with the scheduled, structured meetings and so forth. We don't know how that's going to work, but I think the direction that the legislature gave us, gave to the department through the requirement to do this website, and it was a very good idea, very good recognition that the public wants more opportunity to see what's going on with their tax dollars and have input into what's going on with their tax dollars. And we believe that this is the cornerstone that will be set us off to be able to do that in a much better way than we've ever done it before. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Tindall, Representative Boone.
It's not so much a question, but I just want to tell you how much I like TripCheck, and I'm looking forward to this too. And I do get updates from Adam Torgerson, I think his name is, and as to road projects in my district, and so I can forward that on to other people when they say, what's the deal with, you know, things like that. But I am one of those people, if they limit me to 100 miles a year, I'm not even going to make it down here one way. So keep up the good work. Never let TripCheck die.
All right.
I live by it.
All right. We will continue to keep that going.
All right. Other questions for Mr. Tindall? Any other questions? We appreciate the update, and we are anxious in our next update from you to hopefully see more projects underway, and always keep us abreast too if there are changes, issues, impediments, you know, let us know that in those updates as we move through getting people on the ground and getting some of this stuff done.
Great. Thank you,
Mr. Tindall. So we'll close the informational hearing on projects on House Bill 2001, Representative Byer.
And we're going to keep jumping back and forth, and I'm going to open the informational hearing on the streetcar fund. This is a report that was required to come back to the interim legislature. So, Michael Ward.
Good afternoon, Chair Byer, Chair Metzger, members of the committee. I'm Michael Ward. I'm the administrator of the Public Transit Division. And let me assure you, I understand the value you place on brevity. So I will try to make my report brief and to the point. The 2009 legislature passed House Bill 3379, and it asked ODOT to do three things. One, to determine if the Oregon Streetcar Project Fund created in the 2007 session was adequate for the purposes that it was intended to do. Two, if not, could ODOT determine internal funding sources that would be useful to meet an unmet need. And three, be here today to present the report to this committee. As way of background, the 2007 session did create the Oregon Streetcar Project Fund. It funded it with $20 million in lottery-backed funds for the purpose of buying streetcars from an Oregon-owned and an Oregon-based manufacturer. ODOT created a grant program, and as a result of that grant program, awarded the funds to the city of Portland for the purposes of buying streetcars. In complying with House Bill 3379, we work closely with the City of Portland to identify any unmet needs that those funds wouldn't address. And as you'll see in the report that I passed out, there's an exhibit on the back that identifies about $2 million in essentially spare parts that the City of Portland would need to fill out the expansion of their streetcar system. ODOT, in complying with 3379, found three internal sources for potential revenue sources for that unmet need. The first, of course, was the interest that's earned on the bonds that are in the streetcar fund. The second was Connect Oregon 3. And the third was the federal flexible funds dedicated to the Oregon Transportation Commission, and which there was some lively discussion earlier in the day about. I'd like to stop here and just mention that the applications for Connect Oregon 3 were due November 20th, and ODOT did not receive an application from the City of Portland for this purpose. And with that, that's concludes my testimony. That's our report. There is about $2 million of unmet need. We identified three potential sources within ODOT that might met that need. Those are contained in the report. We did deliver the report to the Oregon Transportation Commission in November of this year, and we're here today so that I can answer any other questions that you might have.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Shelfer?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I will.
How many the manufacturers of these spare parts, don't they, is there a long waiting list if you had to order a propulsion system? So you just have that on a shelf somewhere? And how do you determine, you know, what are we going to have on the shelf or not? There's a big pile of money sitting on that shelf. What's the process there? Can you just order a propulsion system and a couple months later get one, or is that not the case?
Chair Pyre, Chair Metzger, Representative Shelfer, I don't know. I know the City of Portland has contracted with Oregon Iron Works out of Milwaukee, Oregon, for the construction of these streetcars. They're being built here, but the particulars around how parts are ordered and lead times, I really don't know, sir.
The reason I ask, Madam Chair, if I may, I just don't want millions of dollars of parts just sitting there gathering dust. It's just not a good use. That being said, you know, I know what it's like to have your truck break down. You need a part, and you got to put it on. So,
thank you. Any further questions? Oh, yeah, I got him.
Oh, okay.
He wanted to go last.
He's a wallflower over there. Keep an eye on him.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you. Mr. Ward, thank you for your presentation. I want to clarify a few things in your report on the prospective sources of funding. Number one is lottery bond interest revenue, but in your dialogue you say you don't think it's going to generate any revenue. Is that correct? So is that a phantom source, or did I read this wrong?
No,
you said no excess earnings projected.
Chair Byer, Chair Metzger, there is some amount of earnings based on the interest from the bonds. To date, it's been about $120,000. That we're just now starting to cover the cost of the issuance of the bonds. Those are about $122,000. So I did not do an analysis on what the total amount might be at the end of the life of the bond, it's hard to do that not knowing exactly when City of Portland will submit reimbursement requests to pay that. No, there will be some interest earnings that can be dedicated to this project, but I would caution to add that it won't be in the $2 million range.
Okay, well, I guess my point is the language in your report just says right now ODOT projects, so that's future looking, no excess interest earnings. So that's where the confusion came from.
I'm sorry about that.
One thing I would ask Mr. Ward is in looking at the project timeline with the City of Portland and Oregon Ironworks, if we could get a at least a snapshot of what that timeline would be and disbursement, so we can at least get an idea. I think that would be helpful for you and the department to see what that potential interest income would be. I think it would be proper to at least as one of the funding sources to use that same fund to help complete the fund. But it would be helpful to look at what the realistic timeline is for Oregon Ironworks to actually need those funds to build those cars. So that was the first thing. Are you aware of, I was surprised in your comment about the submission for Connect Oregon 3, because this is an issue that in fact was brought to us from the partners, and I am surprised then that they did not put in an application. Did you have any conversations about why they did not do so?
I have not. I'm sorry, Chair Byer, Senator Metzger, I have not had a conversation with the City of Portland about why they did not submit a Connect Oregon 3 application.
Okay. All right. That's all I have.
Okay. No other questions over here, so thank you, and we'll go ahead and close the informational hearing on the streetcar fund report.
Okay, now we're going to move ahead to congestion pricing. I have Jason Tell on my list, but I think it's going to be Director Garrett.
Well, I think it's going to be Mr.
Tindall. Mr.
Tindall.
And anybody else?
Chair Metzger, my apologies, Jason is got a call from a congressman I think he's dealing with right now. Hopefully he'll be here in a minute.
Hold it out. Can you back that up a little bit? What are you trying to tell us? We're not as important as some congressman?
No. I think he didn't expect this to move quite so fast.
Oh, I see. Okay. I just want to clarify that for the record.
No ranking of priority.
Right.
Unlike Congress, Mr. Chair.
For the record, Chairman Esker, members of the committee, Doug Tindall, Deputy Director again. As I said, I hope Jason will join me, particularly before we get to the question period of this testimony. Where we are on, this is a report that's required by the bill on that we established congestion pricing pilot and required us to report, required the department to report back. And so I'll go over what we've been doing since the passage of the bill. Actually, prior to the passage of the bill, the Oregon Transportation Commission, as part of the transportation plan, had identified tolling and pricing as an area that needed study and had kicked off a number of papers, which was very fortuitous, given that we came into the congestion pricing pilot in 2009. Not knowing exactly what the parameters were going to be, we discovered that we needed three additional papers that the commission started off after the passage of House Bill 2001. We looked at the national and worldwide experience in congestion pricing, a methodology for assessing the economic impacts of congestion pricing, and a way to do a benefit cost analysis. These are all new things. They're not just off-the-shelf things, and they required some additional research. And so the commission kicked that off, and those papers have been wrapped up, leading to further work. In other words, the model isn't completely developed for the economic impacts, and the benefit cost analysis is not completely developed either. It just instead, or the point that we're at now, gives us the parameters that we should be looking at, and so work continues on those things. So that's some of the kind of behind-the-scenes stuff, I think, on the congestion pricing pilot. A little bit more of the activity in the bill. You know, we're directed to work with the three counties, Clackamas County, Multnomah County, and Washington County, the City of Portland, and Metro, in crafting a congestion pricing pilot. And I think this has led to some really tremendous discussions. We put together a congestion pricing advisory committee made up of those folks, and they've had a couple of meetings. We had one of the nationwide experts from Cambridge Systematics, a gentleman named Jeff Buxbaum, came out and talked about really the first one of the commission additional research projects, which is the experience across the around the world in congestion pricing. And I think one of the most notable things that led to a robust discussion among the group was that you need to agree on why you're doing the pricing. What's the purpose? Obviously, we're working on this because we've got legislative direction to work on it, statutory direction to work on it, but you really need to talk about, are you doing this to try to raise money? Are you doing this to try to relieve congestion? Are you doing it for both purposes? Is there a particular project that you're trying to accomplish? And so as we've started to have those discussions, it's been heartening to see the participation of all of the folks, all of the people named in the bill around the table, to really dig into those sorts of meaty issues. We've not in the testimony, I'll just tell you that they've also, there's a couple of subgroups, a technical advisory committee that's going to start looking at the individual projects, and a communication outreach advisory committee. Again, all five of the entities in the bill and ODOT are participating in that. A couple of things that we need to look at as we move forward, or one thing in particular, the federal role. If we do a congestion pricing pilot on a federal road, on a road that's ever had any federal money on it, we need some approvals from the federal government. We're going to have to work through the NEPA process, the environmental process, and the executive order on environmental justice. So not certainly showstoppers, but just things that we're going to have to think about as we move forward looking at particular projects. And the last thing before, I'm going to describe the steps that we're going to walk through, but I do want to let you know that we applied for a grant with legislative approval for $2.5 million in federal funds that would be along the lines of what the federal government called it, a value pricing program, and it's related to congestion pricing. We did not do it specifically as a result of the bill, but if we get that grant, we will incorporate that grant and the work that can occur for a very broad study of a lot of strategies, congestion pricing being one. We will incorporate that along with what we're doing on the in response to the bill for the congestion pricing pilot. If I can turn you now to the page that has the diagram on it, I'm going to try and describe how we see this working. And if you want to know where we are on this page, we're not. We're actually just slightly to the left of the page. We haven't even got to the project proposals yet. But what we've agreed on is a process to look at a proposal that comes up. Somebody has an idea of where we can implement congestion pricing in this area or on this road. So you need to identify the location. You need to identify all of the things about the project. And then you go into that box that's in bold that is model project proposals. This will be a challenge because some of the existing traffic models, most of the existing traffic models, are going to take some adjustments to accommodate congestion pricing. They don't just readily spit out what happens when you do congestion pricing. And what I mean by that is, if I decide to do congestion pricing in one area and I price a road or a couple of roads in one area, there's going to be diversion. Some people are going to say, no, I don't want to pay that. I'll go a different way. I don't want to recognize the time savings. I don't have a time crunch. I'll go a different way. And the models are going to take some adjustment and then some analysis even of the results of the models to look at that and see if we're really achieving what we want to achieve, which is an overall good. You may, for instance, you could potentially relieve congestion in one area but create more congestion in many more areas, and the models will help us understand that. The And that's really the first step of the initial assessment, the traffic diversion. And then we get into what are going to be the environmental requirements. They can vary depending on what the impacts are. We'll tell you, do I have to do a full environmental document? Can I do, there's a couple of other ones called a categorical exclusion. That's the minimal level, and there's one in between. And you really will need to understand what we're doing and what the impacts are to judge which one of those environmental documents we're going to have to follow, and the environmental justice actions, and then look at the overall system performance. And so all of that information will go to the Congestion Pricing Committee, where they may say, let's refine this a little bit. Maybe we're too broad. Maybe we're too narrow. Let's look at something else. And you go back, loop back through that analysis portion. They may say, no, there's no way that we can see that this is ever going to work. Or they may say, let's move this on to the second phase assessment, where you're going to go into more detail in terms of how much is this going to cost to build, how much revenue are we going to generate, is there a net benefit there, and then I think in the economic effects, I talked about this a little bit in terms of the second paper that the commission has directed us to develop. But what does this do if I do congestion pricing in one area? Does it make that area less competitive from an economic standpoint? And so that's an analysis that goes on in the second phase, along with air quality and greenhouse gas emissions. And again, you reach another choice point. I think that the two things I'd like to tell you in terms of this process as a whole, a couple, I guess maybe more than two things. One, it's a very thoughtful process. It allows for the check-in points, the analysis that we need to do, and it comes with the buy-in of all of the agencies there. As I said, we're not even at the initial project proposals yet. And you don't just fly through all of this analysis. This is going to take us some time. 36-month implementation for the pilot project is very challenging. But we will try and move as quickly as we can through this process and come up with a pilot project that really tests out congestion pricing, and so we can see the benefits and the effects of pricing. I think with that, if I left anything out, I think with that, I'm ready for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Tindall. Questions for Mr. Tindall? Okay.
All right.
Thank you. We'll close that informational hearing and turn the gavel back over to Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Chair Metzger. So we are now done with informational hearings, and we are going to open up a public hearing on legislative concept 140. Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. LC 140 will sound remarkably familiar. When I did the run-through of LC 24 earlier for the Senate committee, that LC and LC 140 are, with one exception, identical. The single exception being LC 140, the House version, does not include the language dealing with the photo radar signage requirement, but everything else within LC 140 is identical to that in LC 24. I could go further if you'd like, or if that would suffice.
That works fine. Okay. Thank you. And I'm going to go ahead and ask Matt Garrett to come up.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. Good afternoon. For all intents and purposes, Madam Chair, Mr. Brennan's articulation of LC 24 kind of stole my thunder, to be very honest with you. There were four items that we worked with the committee to prepare: the two Connect Oregon issues with regard to the fee on Connect Oregon 2 and does it transfer to 3, and then the fund allocation, making sure it met that 50-30-20 split. We've had a conversation before several months ago. We also have the medium speed vehicles. Again, the language somewhat compromises to draft the appropriate medium speed safety standards. Those don't exist. And so this change will allow us to craft, and Mr. Costales and his transportation safety folks stand ready to do that should this language move forward. And then finally, vehicle variance permits. This amends the variance permit statute to exempt trucks from operating in exclusive use lanes, left turn lanes, center lanes, biped lanes, as those over-dimensional trucks try to navigate throughout the state to move commerce and goods. Right now, we're trying to make sure the statute complies with what is a safe and longstanding practice here. We do not want to compromise the movement of freight, goods, and services throughout the state of Oregon. So those were the four initiatives that we had worked with the committee, and I just stand ready to answer any questions you may have on those four. And I've also, if you want a deep dive, brought the division administrators to share some thoughts with you as well.
Any questions? Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, is it my understanding that, say, the first three of these sections in some way relate to House Bill 2001 and some of the provisions, but the last one I don't remember having anything to do?
That's correct.
Thank you.
It's a new thing.
Any other questions? And we do actually have, if you had any questions on that one, we do have Mr. Russell and then Paloma at ODOT that can answer. So,
Madam Chair, I assume we will have a hearing on in regular session. I will await that with bated breath.
All right. Thank you. And I don't see any other questions,
thank you, Madam
so
Chair.
Thank you. And then I'm going to call up Craig Campbell and Cheryl Gripsko. I think most members have probably been appraised of their interest in the bill.
Chair Beyer, Chair Metzger, and members of the committees. For the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm here on behalf of two different clients on two different issues. So with the chair's permission, I'll start with AAA, and then we'll deal with the Travel Information Council issue in relatively short order. We're asking whether or not it would be possible for us to have amendments made to LC 140 to include two issues, one of which was contained in House Bill 2001 and one which was not. The legislature passed House Bill 2040 last session. House Bill 2040 was the bill that provided for an expansion of the Give Them Room law, which requires a motorist, when they're coming upon an emergency vehicle pulled over on the freeway with their lights flashing, to move over and slow down. We expanded that to include roadside assistance vehicles and tow trucks. Unfortunately, when we passed the bill, the term that was used to designate when you need to slow down and by how much, the term posted speed limit was used. And unfortunately, posted speed limit does not apply to areas of the state that follow the basic rule, which is most of rural Oregon. And so we would like to seek an amendment that would say posted speed limit or designated speed, because that takes into account the basic rule and would apply the law statewide as was intended. So that is the AAA portion of what we're requesting by way of an amendment. And the other one is an amendment to the Travel Information Council portion of House Bill 2001, which granted the Travel Information Council $3 million annually to upgrade, maintain, and manage eight different rest areas throughout the state. Part of the challenge that we have is that because the Travel Information Council is a semi-independent state agency, they do not have the authority to borrow money. And if they wish to purchase or have the buying power to construct buildings, for instance, new restrooms, they will need to have the ability to seek some level of borrowing so that they can make that happening. So the other amendment we would like to pursue is one that would grant them the ability to do borrowing so that they would be able to take care of the responsibilities that were granted to them via House Bill 2001. And with that, I'll turn it over to Cheryl for... Actually, I should ask if you had any questions about the first one before I go on, but...
Any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask you to be kind to Mr. Campbell. He was on his deathbed 2 days ago. And he looks pretty good.
Chair Byer, Chair Metzger, and Representative Boone, antibiotics are a wonderful thing.
Glad to see you up and around.
Okay. No questions.
Chair Byer, Chair Metzger, and members of the committee, my name is Cheryl Gripsko. I'm the CEO of the Oregon Travel Information Council. When we received our semi-independent status in 1993, the idea, the legislative intent, was that we would function as an entrepreneurial agency from that point on. And we have always operated under other funds. We have permits, fees from signs, and we do sales and in on the web, and we also have rest area advertising. And so all of that is other fund money that we have used. But what we learned in the course of the management capability of these rest areas is that we have no way of borrowing money from the state system, the state treasurer, at all. We also didn't put any language in 1993 that would allow us to have any borrowing capability with a private financial institution. And one of the improvements we want to do in the rest areas is move the nonprofit coffee service people out of those silver trailers. And that would expand an awful lot of capability for other nonprofits, because we would provide them with a building that would have what they need to set up their coffee service, provide that to the visitor, and then the other side would be brochures and local information and regional information so that we can increase the economic development. The upshot of that is that the more people we can get working in those rest areas on a 24-hour period, the more we can make them safer for the traveler, because it tends to disperse any activity that is not of a safe nature. So that's the reason that we're requesting this amendment, is to allow us to provide those kinds of buildings.
And Chair Metzger, one other addition. I was asked to make sure we put on the record that it goes without saying that any revenues that were used from as a result of highway funds could only be used for things that are constitutionally approved for highway funds, and the ownership of any structures that were built would belong to the state.
Mm-hmm. And only the other funds would build any of these visitor buildings. Mm-hmm.
All right. Questions? Seeing none. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it. And no other questions about LC 140 something?
140.
We'll close the public hearing on LC 140 and open a public hearing on LC 208. Patrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This LC 208 specifies the amount of time that an owner has to remove a non-compliant electronic sign to make such a sign comply with the current law or to request a review hearing. The measure has an emergency clause. I'd go into further detail, but I think Amy's better qualified and has written testimony, and she's who I learned all this stuff from anyway, so.
Chair Beyer, Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. I'm here just to give a brief explanation of the contents of this legislative concept, which is not from the department, but bears probably some explanation. LC 208 would accelerate the enforcement against electronic variable message signs that violate the state's sign laws. The state regulates signs that are on private property where visible to state highways. This is a federal requirement, and in addition to that, there are additional state laws on top of the federal minimum. And one of the reasons we regulate is because the threat of a 10% penalty to our highway funds if we don't satisfy the federal minimums. Current Oregon law prohibits any outdoor advertising sign from using an electronic variable message component, or EVM, that changes that message intermittently. Current law does allow for these EVM signs to change intermittently if your sign is not an outdoor advertising sign. And the law defines outdoor advertising sign as one that is either for compensation or one that is not at the location of some kind of business or activity open to the public. So what LC 208 would do is, when the department determines that a sign violates that prohibition on electronic variable message signs and we issue a violation notice, it would speed up the amount of time that the alleged violator had to either fix the problem or request a hearing. Under current law, you get 30 days after our notice to either request a hearing or fix the violation. LC 208 would, for this particular kind of violation, allow only 10 days to do that. And that is simply what the concept would do.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Berger.
Amy, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. You went through this pretty fast, Amy, and I presume we'll hear more. But this is coming from a federal mandate that we have to, in a special session, rush out and do this?
Chair Beyer, Chair Metzger, Representative Berger, no. The federal requirement is not part of that. I was just giving the thumbnail version of why ODOT cares about signs along highways.
Okay.
Legislative concept came out and is here before us, and I'm simply here explaining what it would do.
I'm trying to get at what the emergency is here.
Mm-hmm. Chair Beyer, Chair Metzger, Representative Berger, I don't have any information on that.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative.
What was the rationale between 10 days to take a sign down versus another time period?
Chair Beyer, Chair Metzger, Representative Doherty, I don't know necessarily other than the part of the law that restricts the use of electronic variable messages is in the part of the law that really addresses safety concerns versus just sort of beautification issues. So my rough understanding would be that it would probably be an issue of safety, although again, not having been the drafter, I'm not sure what the rationale was in that regard.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative George.
Thank
Senator
you.
George, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Amy, In my district, a lot of rural food stands, farmers markets type things have these electronic signs they put up for like 15, 20 days for pumpkins or for some kind of like blueberry picking or whatever, and they use these portable electronic signs. I don't want those folks to be shut down, and yet the way I read it, they would be under this because they basically pull those things in there for like 30 days and turn them on and let you know that you can pick a pumpkin there, and then they're out of there.
Chair Beyer, Chair Metzger, Senator George, my unfortunate answer is it depends. It depends on whether that sign is outdoor advertising or not. So if that sign was right at the pumpkin patch, then and they weren't, receiving compensation to advertise for others as well, then actually that's the kind of sign where this is specifically allowed under current law, so they wouldn't fall under that. Now, if the sign was elsewhere, just, out in a field with nothing going on around it, now you do fall under that provision.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and specifically, Amy, I'm thinking about one that I know of. I have about four of them I can think of that use these at different times of the year, but one of them puts it a quarter mile ahead on somebody else's property and says, pumpkins, one quarter mile ahead, and it flashes. So I want to put you out there. There's some people out there that are doing it from a pretty realistic perspective, and if we could kind of make sure we allow those kind of things, that'd be nice.
Chair Beyer, Chair Metzger, Senator George, and again, if there wasn't any other business, it doesn't have to be the same business, but if there's nothing else going on around it, you're correct, that would fall under this provision as the LC is drafted.
Good, thank you.
Okay.
Pumpkins and cherries.
Yeah.
No other questions? And thank you, Amy.
Thank
appreciate
you.
Your coming. Given that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on LC 208. And committee, I think our business is done.
Do you want me to go through the process by which these will be introduced?
Or will they? Sure, you can explain it. I think I understand. But
thank you, Madam Chair. The way that the House process for bill introduction will happen this session is that on the first day of session, the committees will, each House committee is designated about 20 minutes to meet. They already have the schedule set up. I don't have it in front of me, but each committee will meet for about 20 minutes. During that meeting, they will adopt rules, and at that point, the committees will vote to introduce the bills.
Got
so
it.
The committees will have a chance to vote on it. It just won't be until the first day of session.
And my understanding is by holding these public hearings today, we can post 48 hours
72
ahead.
Hours.
72 hours ahead for the first day of session.
Got it. Mm-hmm.
So
thank you.
There'll be time to
that'd be good.
Figure them out. And with that, the House committee is adjourned.
And Senate members, Within the next few days, I believe all the bills, individual committee bills, will be public. And I would ask that, I know the committee likes to have, you know, good things to work on and during the February session, if you would review those bills, and if there are any in particular that you would ask me to advocate to the Senate President to come to this particular committee, let me know. And feel free also to talk to Phil in the President's office so that otherwise, and to what level you would like me to advocate for them. And we will do our best to have the some good things for the committee to work on in February.
Okay. And if the House members haven't figured out, we have no assigned member bills in our committee. So.
And with that, we're adjourned.
Yeah.